In the coming week, criticism mounts over China's coronavirus response. East African countries face a huge new wave of locusts, and the 75th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day is commemorated. It's May 7th, 2020, in time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, I want to note for our listeners that you and I are practicing social distancing and recording this podcast from our respective homes. Because of that, we apologize in advance for any audio issues and for any unscheduled guest appearances on the episode.
Well, thanks, Jim. We're going to start, as always, on the virus front with this podcast. In the past week, President Trump and his Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, have said they believe there is a significant amount of evidence that indicates that the coronavirus, or COVID-19, as the disease is known, originated in a laboratory in Wuhan, China. This is part of what is leading to an escalation in tensions between the United States and China. So, Jim, can you talk about why this emphasis, particularly in the past week, on this front?
Happy to do so, Bob. I think it's pretty clear that a lot of allegations are being leveled and also disputed, though so far no one has produced much evidence one way or the other. But I think maybe the best place to start is with two areas of agreement. The first is that I think there's widespread agreement, not just in the United States, but in capitals around the world, that China wasn't transparent about the disease when it first surfaced in late 2019. And indeed, some of the steps that China took to inform the world about the disease, like releasing the virus's genome in mid-January, wasn't actually a decision that Beijing had approved. And there's even some evidence to suggest that China may have used December and early January to stockpile necessary medical gear and masks. So in no sense is China a hero here. Second point of agreement I would note is that a lot of countries around the globe now are complaining about what they see as heavy-handed Chinese efforts to compel them to praise China for its response. There's been a lot of articles written in European capitals about heads of state being pressured by Chinese ambassadors to show appropriate thanks and respect for the generosity of the Chinese government, the Chinese people, in terms of providing things like masks and other medical equipment. And again, this is partly playing into or partly driven by China's desire to have a narrative in which it is extending a helping hand to the world. I think many of the recipients don't feel like they're getting a helping hand, but are rather being coerced. But let's get back to the allegations that President Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo laid out. As you mentioned, both men talked about how they believe the outbreak had originated in a lab accident in China. And both mentioned that there was significant evidence that this was true, though neither the president nor the secretary of state has actually pointed to any evidence. And I want to be really clear here about what the president and the secretary of state were alleging or have been alleging and what they're not. They didn't allege that China created or manufactured the virus. On that score, the U.S. intelligence community, like the broader scientific community, has concluded that the virus is a naturally occurring one. President Trump and Secretary of State Pompeo also didn't claim that China deliberately released the virus. Trump described the supposed lab release as a mistake, and Pompeo said this weekend that he had no reason to believe that the virus had been deliberately spread. Now, here's where you get into that gray area of uncertainty. Accidental transmission from a lab is theoretically possible. In the case of Wuhan, there are actually two labs in the city. One is what we call a biosafety level 4 lab. The other is a biosafety level 3 lab. Now, both labs are believed to have had coronaviruses on their premises. Now, that in itself doesn't signify anything unusual. You would expect labs to study such viruses that are associated with illnesses in humans.
For example, SARS is a coronavirus.
Exactly. So you would expect labs to have these sort of things. And again, they have precautions to prevent their release. I will note that back in 2018, a U.S. State Department expert who visited the lab in Wuhan that's a BSL-4, biosafety level 4 lab, raised concerns that the lab had a serious shortage of appropriately trained technicians and investigators needed to safely operate. So in theory, it's possible that you could have had a lab accident. We all know that with this virus, it is possible to be infected and be non-symptomatic. So it is possible, theoretically, for someone to have become infected and then unknowingly spread the disease. I guess another possibility is if these viruses were injected into animals and those animals passed and weren't properly disposed of, you could have another potential vector for transmission. So in theory, origination of the virus from a lab is possible. The question is, do we have any evidence of it? And this is where you begin to get the rebuttals and the demurrals. I'll note that the Office of the Director of National Intelligence issued a statement last week saying it had not established the virus had escaped from a lab. There's also a report prepared by the Five Eyes. This is an intelligence sharing partnership among the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom. That report concluded that China covered up early news of the epidemic, but it didn't find any evidence that the virus came from a lab accident. Now, the Australian government's public position is that there's only a small chance the virus came from a biolab, and they think it's more likely that it came from the wet market. European capitals seem to share that view. Now, let me just sort of make three quick final points. One is that a lot is made of the fact that the bats that carry the coronavirus aren't found within 100 miles of Wuhan, and that presumably strengthens the story that it must have come from a lab. But the problem with that explanation is that we know people travel. Again, it's not too hard to imagine someone who'd been in contact with bats coming into Wuhan and infecting others. Second point I make is that a number of critics like to note that China has rejected calls for an international inquiry into the origins of the virus, and they've taken China's refusal as evidence that it's guilty. But it's hardly surprising when you think about it, Bob, that a powerful sovereign country would deny outsiders the right to investigate its internal operations. I mean, just imagine how the United States would react if an international body demanded to investigate the decision-making that led the United States to invade Iraq. Washington would flatly reject the idea. So Chinese refusal to cooperate isn't proof in itself that the Chinese are covering up an accident at a lab. And I think the third point to keep in mind is whether the virus came from the laboratory or not. We may never know. You know, it hardly explains the failure of the Trump administration to act promptly when it knew that the country faced a potential pandemic. Again, U.S. intelligence community knew about the virus's potential impact in early January. It was in the presidential daily brief. There were alarm bells going off in various parts of the U.S. government throughout January, and the Trump administration chose not to act. Again, the president in February was talking about how this wasn't a concern for the United States, the numbers were going to go down, and the like. And so whatever happened in China doesn't explain why it is that the United States didn't activate the procedures and processes that it should have to help us combat the coronavirus.
Jim, are you seeing any indication that, you know, this ramped up amount of connections that the administration's making between China, a laboratory, and the origins of the virus? First of all, that this is going to continue, and then any sense that we're going to get into a heavily escalating sense of not only rhetoric, but maybe other actions between U.S. and China?
Well, I expect it's going to continue, Bob. I mean, one does not have to be too skeptical or cynical not to see why the Trump administration wouldn't see attacking China as politically useful at home. President's running for re-election. It's pretty clear that the virus originated in China. This is a, I think, fairly straightforward way to try to deflect some of the blame for the pandemic off the administration's response onto China. So for that reason, the incentive to do so is going to continue. Likewise, I want to make clear that I don't think China has been a hero in this narrative. It's actually been quite the opposite. The Chinese have floated this idea that the coronavirus originated in the U.S. Army and the U.S. Army spread it in China. You know, the Chinese have played a significant role in upping the tensions here. Here we get back to this broader issue of the mixed messages that the Trump administration expends in its China policy. On the one hand, the president's very critical of China. On the other hand, he's full of praise for the president of China, talks how they're going to work together, going to do deals together, and the like. And so you sort of have those sort of competing or conflicting messages going back and forth, and I imagine they will continue. The president has, as you know, Bob, put a lot of stress on his abilities as a deal maker. One of the deals that he's held up as evidence of his prowess as a deal maker is this phase one deal with China. at some point with his criticism of China, he runs the risk of putting that deal in jeopardy. How would he react under those circumstances? I will note that the president had previously been referring repeatedly to this as a China virus. After a phone call with President Xi, that appears to have stopped. It may come back, but it seems to have tailed off for a while. And indeed, one of the really interesting questions as you look at the playing out of that so-called phase one deal is whether it is still a doable deal given the situation we're in right now. You might remember that one of the promises the Chinese made under the deal is they were going to up the amount of goods they bought from the United States. One obvious place to do that is to buy more American food products. We got a problem now. China has a big appetite for hogs, but as we discussed on the podcast last week, the U.S. meatpacking industry is faced with a really big challenge. You have a lot of sick employees. Production of meats has gone down. So you have a situation which the Chinese want to buy, let's say, pork products from the United States. Either they won't be able to get them because there's a shortage, or it drives up the price, not just for the Chinese, but for Americans writ large. So there's a lot of factors in play here. But I expect that the Trump administration and the Xi Jinping administration are going to be saying some pretty unpleasant things about each other. And again, I want to be very clear, the Chinese have been not only tough in talking about the United States, they have been tough talking about any leadership they believe is critical of them, most notably the Australians, which have called for an international investigation of the origins of the virus. And that has led spokespeople in Beijing to essentially threaten Australia with a consumer boycott. You know, if you push this, then Chinese citizens being good patriots won't buy Australian wine and Australian beef products and the like. So, you know, China's throwing a lot of its weight around, which gets back to the bigger issue that a rising China, to the extent it gets to shape world rules, is not going to shape in ways that favor either the United States or Western values more broadly.
I wonder if, as the U.S. ramps up this campaign, then, as you say, showing no signs that this is going to abate and, in fact, will play heavily into certainly the presidential campaign, that the U.S. risks maybe antagonizing what would normally be allies in this cause, which, as you mentioned, you know, certainly the Australians, but also the Europeans, other countries that have been dismayed by China's actions, have not liked to see it asserting itself more broadly in, say, U.N. institutions. It looks to be increasing its role potentially in the WHO. There's been some movement towards trying to get Taiwan representation in WHO, which China has always been vehemently against. But do you think that there's sort of a complicated set of movements going on right now, and at the end of the day, the U.S. might need to be more skillful about it?
I certainly think it would help if the United States were more skillful about it, Bob, but President Trump has been consistent on this from the get-go. I mean, the president is deeply skeptical of cooperation. He's deeply skeptical of alliances and allies. He's a big believer the United States should act as it sees fit. And that response, which is embodied in this whole notion of America first, has played out over the coronavirus crisis. I mean, the president has not, as a sort of a first reaction, said what we need to do is bring together like-minded countries to handle this together. He's gone off and made the decisions. And if that aggravates and alienates friends and allies, so be it. But again, that has been consistent over the course of the Trump administration in his approach to foreign policy. I do think it is a significant opportunity lost because, as you point out, you say the WHO situation, you may not like the WHO or think it could do better, but I can't imagine a policy that is more likely to make the WHO even more ineffective, even more beholden to China than to boycott the organization and let the Chinese be the only one at the table. I mean, across a whole range of diplomatic issues in this administration, what you notice is that the Americans don't show up, but the Chinese do. And a lot of these international organizations matter for a whole variety of issues that affect us in our everyday life. So I think it's a bad play by the administration. But Bob, I think it's time for us to move on to a different issue. And I want to talk about an issue that has become increasingly grave. It involves East Africa, which now faces its second desert locust infestation. This infestation is projected, if I'm reading the stats correctly, to be 20 times worse than the infestation that hit the region just 2 months ago. The United Nations noted that this presents, and let me quote them here, an extremely alarming and unprecedented threat, end quote, to food security and living conditions in Eastern Africa. My understanding is we're talking about trillions with a T of locusts. Bob, so can you tell us what's happening on the ground and if this is intersecting at all with the pandemic that some of these countries are also facing?
Certainly, Jim, and it definitely looks to be intersecting with the pandemic, both the reality of the pandemic as well as the air of gloom. You know, it's bad enough to be continuing to confront the pandemic, but when people heard locusts, you know, the sort of collective response is like, are you kidding me? But the numbers are all too real. You mentioned the numbers. The first swarms, which were quite large and were already alarming, were in the billions. Some said hundreds of billions. Well, guess what? They nested, and a second wave now that, as you said, is in the trillions has created swarms primarily in three countries. Two hardest hit are Ethiopia and Kenya. Somalia increasingly also hit, possibly seeing them verging into Uganda as well. And what's especially alarming is we're approaching kind of a crucial period involving the agricultural sowing in these countries. And there is yet a third wave that's feared of this current crop of locusts themselves nesting, laying eggs, and you'll have an even bigger infestation. As one official quoted in the Washington Post today said, you know, it's still characterized mostly as pest. It could be more broadly a pestilence, which is a much broader infestation that just starts wiping out crops, period. And locusts have done this before in Africa. Africa has been particularly hard hit by this problem, which is a cyclical problem. Among the ways the coronavirus pandemic has affected this is that many of the pesticides that are used, are typically used to spray into these clouds, are based in Kenya. Kenya is one of the hub offices where the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization is based. There are border holdups now to cross from country to country because of concerns of a virus spread. Those same border holdups are holding up things like pesticides. So that's a problem. Even with the freer flow of those, there are officials saying, you know, given the scale of these clouds, they don't see the spraying by drones or manned aircraft with the current level of equipment doing much to stop them. They're talking about a much higher magnitude of craft involved, of spraying, and of efforts to prevent the nesting and so forth that they don't currently possess. And so it's happening on top of an already a food alarm has gone out. We talked a couple of weeks ago about the World Food Program chief talking about biblical famine looming, the locusts playing part of that, but there were other drivers as well. Something like 135 million people in Africa facing food insecurity. It is the last thing this particular region needs, which knows famine all too well. Again, it's a problem that requires a marshaling of resources, requires outside aid for these countries, and it's at a time of just exhaustion in terms of the aid front because of so many other competing factors.
What do farmers do in a situation like this, Bob? I mean, how do you try to harvest your crop early? I mean, the scale of this is so large. I'm just trying to imagine what response can be made on the ground.
I think it's a good question, Jim. You know, it's not really clear what they can do other than, you know, trying to take whatever crop they can, get it into safety so that they can feed their animals. I mean, one of the key needs for this, according to the reports I've seen, is feed not so much for humans necessarily, but for livestock, which are a crucial part of these smaller communities that make up these vast areas in, say, northern Kenya, southeastern Ethiopia, western Somalia. And if they find themselves with their sort of their crops denuded, you know, you have all this cattle, goats, and so forth that are a crucial part of the diet and of the ecosystem of these places, suddenly they're going to just starve, and human starvation follows that.
So it could be like a slow motion crisis. Indeed, in the beginning, you may actually have extra meat because you're slaughtering animals before they starve to death, but eventually you run out of both kinds of food.
That is correct. It's interesting. The reports coming out now are coming out at a time when officials are still able to kind of take stock and start some planning because winds have been such, and I think winds affect the movement of these swarms more than anything else currently, and they've pushed them into an area, sort of a less populated, less crop-rich area, especially of Kenya and Ethiopia at the moment. But it's only a matter of time before the winds change. And again, they come into these areas during a time of crucial sowing or places where their harvest is going on. Also following rainy season, where you have usually triggers improvement and development of crops, you have trillions of ravenous locusts coming, and it just wipes it out. And so again, it's a combination of the mitigation efforts can only go so far. At the end of the day, it's appealing to outside sources. It's typically through the UN agencies and through the richer donor countries, all of whom are strapped in various ways.
Yeah, I was going to say they're under a lot of pressure right now.
Yeah, exactly. And so there have been appeals for all sorts of things in terms of, you know, trying to keep the coronavirus from refugee communities. There are hundreds of millions of people who are migrants, either displaced within countries or across borders. And there are wars still going on. The UN was hoping for a coronavirus ceasefire of sorts in places like Libya and Syria. Hasn't worked that well. And so on top of it, then you get East Africa, you know, raising the flag about locusts, and it just sort of creates a bit of a shrug. And that's what's worrying people in the region. So it's something to watch. It is something that does really kind of go with the wind. So let's keep an eye on the wind. Maybe you get a lucky wind that blows them out over the sea or something, and the locusts eventually die. That's happened before as well. But it's something else to keep an eye on, and for, you know, the world to try to pull together on. Because again, as I said, the convergence of this with the coronavirus, where you suddenly have a weakening of whatever infrastructure was in these countries that further, you know, could exacerbate a spread of the virus. And then you have something else to worry about on top of famine.
Yeah, I mean, just a reminder of how powerful Mother Nature is.
Yeah, you're hearing terms like biblical and terms that you haven't heard used in millennia, Jim. So it's just one of these time periods for us to kind of slog through. Jim, I want to turn to a little bit more of a celebratory mood as we look back at a major anniversary, and that would be the 75th anniversary of Victory in Europe Day, also known widely as VE Day. It marks the 1945 surrender of German forces that effectively ended World War II in Europe. Jim, you've done a lot on your blog, on the website, noting this period of time. Your Twitter feed typically notes historical occasions involving this. What can you tell us that we should be looking at in terms of the significance of this day?
Well, Bob, it's certainly a great historical moment, and 1945 more generally is one of the most significant years in world history. I will note that Britain in particular will be celebrating VE Day. They're going to do so with a national remembrance that's marked by 2 minutes of silence. There'll also be a televised commemorative address by Queen Elizabeth. She's going to speak at the exact moment that her father, King George VI, gave a radio address to the British people. There's also going to be a video of Prince Charles reading an excerpt from his grandfather's diary from VE Day. So that partly reminds us of that moment. But as I think of VE Day today, Bob, I mostly think of it now as kicking off an era whose end we may now be witnessing. In that era, which really began in 1945, is the appearance of an American-led world. You know, what Franklin Roosevelt, who had died 2 months earlier, and his successor, Harry Truman, sought to do was to find a way to avoid a repeat of the events that had embroiled the United States in its Second World War in less than 25 years. Now, during the 1930s, you recall the original America First movement had argued that if the United States stood apart from the world, it would be safe, and Americans stood apart from the world and still became embroiled. And the lesson that FDR and Truman took from that was that the notion that the United States could stand apart from the world was a mirage, that the United States had to actively shape its environment. And they were remarkably successful, didn't always get things right, but they created a sort of very different world order, as political scientists like to say. And I think over the last 5 or 6 years, we're seeing the United States increasingly turning its back from that leadership role. We just spoke a moment ago about how the United States, in the wake of the pandemic crisis, didn't instinctively turn to like-minded countries, try to organize them, but rather sort of went on its own. And I think we're seeing the results of that, which is that international cooperation doesn't magically occur in the absence of a country that can organize others. Countries all tend to go off and do their own thing. You see a rise of nationalism. Countries compete. And the results are, if I can borrow that wonderful term economists like to use, suboptimal. And I think that we're going to be seeing more of it in the future, in part because the United States, unlike 75 years ago, no longer has the will or the skill to try to lead, organize others to promote cooperation and tackle issues of mutual concern.
Well, and I think it's an important point, and I would hope there would be more reflection of that during this anniversary, Jim, and maybe this summer as well with the Victory in Japan anniversary, in that while it was a Democratic administration that got this launched, this really became a bipartisan thing that spanned generations in the U.S. There was sort of this sense, not fully shared by both parties, but certainly there was a sort of internationalist consensus in the U.S. being in the forefront of building up these international structures and really being the backbone behind a lot of, you know, setting up of the U.N. obviously NATO, World Trade Organization, and now sort of turning against its own architecture and the turning back seeming to accelerate under Republicans. But there was some sentiment of that shared by Democrats as well. So it's a chance for reflection about, you know, as you did so well in your book, The Empty Throne as well, what was the world that the U.S. was largely responsible for building and why did it sour on it so quickly and what allowed it to erode?
Well, I think part of the problem, obviously, in the last 20 years has been the militarization of American foreign policy, invasion of Iraq in many ways being the most obvious. But there was a tendency to sort of forget what was learned during the Cold War, which is that American diplomacy was as important as American military power. And now the argument seems to be that to equate leadership with interventionism, and they're very different things. And again, I just point to the pandemic as a real opportunity for the United States to be able to mobilize others, and we're not taking advantage of it. Because I do think, you know, countries around the world need somebody who can build coalitions, and the United States is basically the only game in town when it comes to that, certainly on a global level. And likewise, as we talked about during the discussion of the coronavirus, the Chinese are not going to organize the world in a way that is going to be friendly to the United States or most of its friends and allies. And I think that's the great troubling thing. So even if the Chinese fail, and they may well, the alternative isn't going to be some sort of rosy scenario, but rising nationalism, cutthroat competition, and increased conflict. And again, history is pretty clear in this. I mean, we've seen the movie before. So I'm a bit pessimistic about the direction that we're headed.
Yeah. And I would just say, you know, it's particularly the erosion of democracy. You know, there was another new report that came out from the Freedom House nonprofit that closely tracks these things about what they call nations in transit. And this is this whole swath of the world, the former Soviet bloc, Eastern Europe, where the erosion just continues to accelerate. And it's really dismaying because it was an area of such hope. As I've mentioned before, you know, I lived in the area for a big chunk of the 1990s, and there was a real momentum there as these countries were, you know, emerging from more than a generation under communism. They were, you know, eagerly, for the most part, seeking to join the European Union and NATO and very much, you know, acting out as democracies on the international stage. And some are trying to hold firm, but it's especially troubling what's going on in Hungary and to a great extent in Poland right now. And you don't want to overuse the term tipping point, but it feels like we're hitting one of those again.
There's certainly a lot of storm clouds on the horizon, Bob. Maybe a stiff wind will come and sort of chart a different course for us, but I do think there's a lot of reason to be concerned. Bob, let's go to our figures of the week. I'm going to let you go first. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Jim, my figure is a number. It's the number 4, as in 4 centimeters, which is the estimated length of the Asian giant hornet.
Oh, that is a frightening insect.
This is an insect that, aside from locusts that we just talked about, maybe we should call this the insects next week or something, or the world's insects next week, Jim. But aside from locusts, this insect got more attention, I would say, certainly on social media in the past week than nearly anything outside of the coronavirus.
It creeped me out.
It's because it has made landfall in the United States. It's been confirmed that the Asian giant hornet has reached Washington State, and it's raised a great deal of concern because of the things that this hornet is capable of doing, Jim. I'm just going to go a little bit into it as described by Science Magazine. It gained the nickname Murder Hornet as well, kind of a supervillain name, because it can cause an extremely painful, if not fatal, sting in swarms to humans. Its most frequent victim, however, it seems to be honeybees, where it has a habit of crawling into hives and ripping off their heads in large numbers. It can just decimate a hive in a short order. And honeybees are already under threat for a variety of reasons and play an incredibly crucial role in agriculture around the world. And so it's alarmed a lot of people that if there's any sort of a large outbreak of this Asian giant hornet against what's seen as a defenseless honeybee, then we're in for a lot more grief, Jim. So it's being watched very closely. I think there are attempts to put trackers and even what they call heat trackers on these hornets to see where they are, where their queens are, where they might be proliferating. It has not been seen outside of Washington State. There have been, ever since that report came out in the past week, there have been all sorts of sightings in other parts of the country that entomologists and other experts have said, you know, are pretty much not the case. But it does raise a lot of concern. The last thing we need, in addition to locusts in East Africa, the last thing we need is a murder hornet in the United States.
2020, Bob, seems to have no shortage of things to keep one up late at night.
Well, Jim, I'll turn to you then. Who or what is your figure of the week?
Well, I'm going to go with a person, so no insects for me.
And it's not Ant-Man, right?
It's not Ant-Man. I'm going to stay away from insects entirely.
Good, good.
My figure of the week is a person named Jordan Goodrow. He is a former U.S. Green Beret who runs a Florida-based private security firm known as Silvercorp USA. Now, this week, Silvercorp apparently helped organize an effort to overthrow Nicolas Maduro, the president of Venezuela. Now, Mr. Goodrow announced the attempted uprising in a video that was shot on Sunday in Florida. Goodrow is seen in the video sitting next to a former Venezuelan National Guard officer, and Goodrow told reporters that the operation had the support and encouragement of the Venezuelan opposition, including the support of opposition leader Juan Guaido. Guaido's office has said it wasn't involved at all with Goodrow and it hadn't signed any agreements with him. Now, this operation did not go well. Didn't go well in part because the intervening forces apparently were well penetrated by spies from the Venezuelan government. And so the Venezuelan government succeeded in stopping what it understandably called a terrorist assault. It killed 8 of the insurgents, captured more than a dozen of them. 2 of the people who were captured turned out to be Americans. Both men are former Green Berets. Now, Mr. Goodrow doesn't seem to be daunted at all. He told Bloomberg News that while the mission to liberate Venezuela had failed, the secondary mission is to set up insurgency camps against Maduro, and that those camps are up and running and recruiting. Now, I think this is an issue to keep an eye on. I mean, one question is the legal liability that Mr. Goodrow faces. As best I can tell, he now has run afoul of a variety of U.S. laws and is being investigated by the Justice Department. And as best we know, the Trump administration in no way greenlighted this assault. This was something cooked up by Venezuelan nationals rather than being an operation of the U.S. government. And I suspect we'll hear some more stories on that score going forward.
It's a fascinating story, Jim. And people have not been able to resist paralleling with Bay of Pigs, of course, the failed attempt to wrest Cuba from Fidel Castro early in the Kennedy administration. But the administration, as you said, has taken pains to say, not our operation. Certainly, there would have been sympathy for such an operation had it succeeded, one would imagine. And the U.S., even during this coronavirus pandemic, one of the areas of activity, of heightened activity in the U.S. policy front seemed to be Venezuela. So it continues to raise a lot of questions. And as they say, follow the money if you try to determine where some of the levers are being pulled here.
I'm glad you raised the historical referent of the Bay of Pigs, Bob, because one of the most telling tweets on this episode that I saw was somebody who said that Mr. Goodrow's effort was the Bay of Pigs meets the Keystone Cops. So, and I think that, as best I can tell from the news coverage, pretty much sums it up.
Well, that's our look at the world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. There are further rounds of talks between the UK and the EU relationship taking place, and the European Parliament is scheduled to meet in Brussels.
But Bob, you left out the most important day. Sunday is Mother's Day. Happy
Absolutely.
Mother's Day, one and all.
Happy Mother's Day.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collins. Thank you, Zoe, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Special thanks go to Anu Kumar, Claire McGraw, and Anna Shortridge for their assistance. This week, our recording engineer was Zoe Collins, who's been pulling double duty. Thank you, Zoe. Our theme music was provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long.